Hey everyone, this is James LaBrie from Dream Theater, and you're listening to Prog Rock Digital.
Welcome to Prog Rock Digital. Hi everyone and welcome back to another episode of Prog Rock Digital. This is episode 3 of season 3. Thank you very much for downloading and streaming. Thank you for visiting progrockdigital.com and please keep those emails coming through. Now, today I'm chatting with Paul Logue, the co-writer to the band and to the artist James LaBrie on the most recent James LaBrie album, Beautiful Shade of Grey. We chat about the recording process, how he caught up with James to initiate the album, and also, well, general conversation in and around the band. The man behind some of the most iconic pieces of art connected to some of the biggest names in rock, Ioannis. Originally from Athens, Greece, in the last 36 years has created over 300 record covers for such clients as King Crimson, Fate's Warning, Uriah Heep, Allman Brothers, Blue Oyster Cult, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Yngwie Malmsteen, Deep Purple, Styx, just to name a few. Be sure to connect with Ioannis at www.dangerousage.com. Coming July 30th, the re-release of Amarin's Plight, Voice in the Light, featuring Gary Werkamp, DC Cooper, and Nick DiVigilio. One of the greatest progressive conceptual albums of the 2000s is with us once again. www.amarinsplight.net.
Out through Lone Wolf Music.
Falsett have released their debut album, We Follow or Lead the Way. Available for download and stream, visit falsett.co.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Zonder with A to Z with the first exclusive Australian interview with Prog Rock Digital.
How's it going, Paul?
It's going great. Yeah, can't be too many complaints from my side.
So, Paul, look, you've released Beautiful Shade of Grey. Now, that was released about a week back, May 20th, out through Inside Out Music. Yep. How does it feel for that album to finally see the light of day and be out? You've received some amazing feedback and reviews up until now.
Mm. Yeah, I think probably the first feeling, Nick, is really one of overwhelming, relief to have it out, because we sat for quite some time with the record finished, because Dream Theater were in the cycle of A View from the Top of the World as well. We're on the same label, so we had to be, I think, 6 months clear of them. So it's been in the can for, I think, the end of maybe October, November last year. So we had that awful long lead time. So that's the first thing, to get it out. And now for me, experiencing the reaction because of working with someone like James, it's the biggest microscope I've ever been under. It's just been a tidal wave of, joy, to be honest. Just some amazing reviews. This is a total departure, of course, for him and his solo work, but when we first hooked up together, he was very adamant from the outset of the style and the approach that he wanted to do. And I think the two of us, plus the other chaps in the album, who've almost completed a band, shall we say, were just blown away by how it sounds and the reaction. And I think as an artist, you sometimes get bogged down too much of all the crap that goes around making a record, and you can sometimes forget why you did it. It was that joy of writing ideas, and James and I unbelievably clicked from the minute we started swapping riffs and ideas. So to hear it all now and see people reacting the way that we first reacted when we let each other hear the ideas has been just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So can you just run through how it is that you bumped into James? My understanding is that you guys randomly met at an airport. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, you obviously picked up a conversation and got the ball rolling, so to speak, after that conversation. Can you just run through that with us?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So, I mean, the backstory is that he guested on Eden's Curse, my band's third album. That would be back in
Trinity.
That's right. So that was out in 2011. We started working around about 2010 on a song. And in actual fact, James sang on the entire record. He helped out with some of the backing vocals. So we had a long period of weeks of working with each other, getting to know each other. And that friendship, as we developed it then, has stood the test of time. We've been great buddies ever since. Every time DT come to the UK, I'll at least try and catch them in my hometown. But they never always do the same cycle. They've always got a few cycles. So I've travelled down to England. I've been to the Czech Republic, would you believe, to catch them on tour as well. And I would always buy him a ticket. I'm not a freeloader, as they call it. That guy like to support the bands that I love. And James will always hook me up with an after show. We get a chance to meet each other, say hello. And the short and long of it is I've been trying to get him on the Distanced Over Time tour. So I was going out to Prague with some friends. I was then seeing them in my hometown and really not like James at all. He wasn't replying back. And I thought, God, I wonder what's happened. But naturally, it's just that he'd changed email addresses. I think being in the public eye like that, James has changed email addresses a few times over the 10 years I've known him. And I think that's all it was. So when they played my hometown in Glasgow, I just didn't get the chance to meet him, of course. I tried emailing him on the day to say that I'm coming. And lo and behold, I'm going to London the next morning for work engagement. I'm walking through Glasgow Airport at something like 8 a.m. in the morning. And I come round the corner from security and there's James and John Myung sitting having a coffee in Costa Coffee. So I walk over and say, hi, James. And he's like, holy shit, Paul, how are you? And we just caught up from there. It was, look, we never saw you last night. I was just wondering that we usually see you at Glasgow. And I said, I emailed you, but you never got back. And he's like, oh, dude, maybe you've got my old email. And we swapped all the latest kind of information with each other. And it was great just to catch up. And it turns out we were actually on the same flight, but we didn't know that at the time. We're both going down to London and I said, look, I really need to get to the gate. And just as I was leaving, he said, look, I know that I've asked you this loads about us doing stuff together. We're off to, I think they were heading off to Asia, but he was aware of the pandemic, but wasn't, you know, nobody knew at that time what was going to happen. And he said, once we get back, I fancy writing a kind of laid back, maybe an acoustic album. Are you interested in doing it with me? I was like, course, dude, you know, you need to ask me twice, you know. And that was it. So we said, let's email each other once I get home. And we found out we were on the same flight anyway, and he was on first and I boarded second, and he reached out and grabbed my hand and said, don't forget to email me. So within maybe 2 weeks of, I think he was going skiing with his wife after the tour, and then they were heading to Asia, we just started emailing each other. And at that point the world shut down with the pandemic. So James was like, okay, why don't we start writing now? We don't know how long this is going to be shut for. And, you know, the rest, as you know, Nick, the rest is all history. It's all a part of, you know, 2 years in lockdown. And that's what we started doing, swapping song ideas, and Beautiful Shade of Grey grew out of that.
Now, the album is totally different to any of the other James LaBrie albums or releases, and I think back to Mull Muzzler and Elements of Persuasion and so on.
Yep.
Can I ask, obviously there is an element of acoustic guitar, and it's acoustic dominated. Was that a strategy from the beginning?
Oh yeah, big time. That was the first thing out of his mouth, even in that coffee shop at that point. I want to try an acoustic-based album. I mean, it was never at any point in time to be nine ballads or anything like that. It was just acoustic was to be the underpinning foundation of the record. We're both big fans of kind of classic rock. And James said, look, the reason I'm asking you is I've always been a huge fan of your writing with Eden's Curse, and it's always reminded me of some of the bands I grew up listening to, the likes of Purple, Zeppelin. We're both big Zeppelin fans. And, you know, he said, look, get your head into the headspace of Zep 3, you know, an easy thing to say, to go and put your head into the mind space of legends. But that actually going away and listening to that album was, you know, it was a real pivotal moment, because I then understood clearly where he was coming from. I think we'd originally talked about doing it just voice and guitar, but as we started working on the songs, we realized that, look, we could outstay our welcome, we could lose interest in the audience after some time. So adding in some of the elements like the drums and especially the keyboards were the first things that we added in, because we had done Devil and Drag, we had written, I think, Wildflower, and we were now working on Sunset Ruin, which was the third song, and being that kind of emotive ballad, we felt, well, this needs strings, this needs a touch of piano here, and okay, let's add in percussion. And as we were getting to those points, it was bringing people in to do them. And we kind of brought in people that we knew well. Obviously, I recommended actually James's son, Chance, which he said, oh, amazing, yeah, and it's better to come from you, Paul, than it is the pushy father. But I had heard Chance play and thought, this kid's amazing, great chops. And he was a brilliant addition. And I brought Christian in from my own band, who's excellent at a lot of pomp and ceremony. He's very big, he's very overblown with his keyboard productions. And I felt that he grew up listening to people like Keith Emerson and John Lord. And, you know, he loved, you know, all of the Dream Theater guys as well. So, I mean, if you see Christian's interviews for the album, he's sitting with the Dream Theater keyboard anthology behind him. You know, I just felt he would be perfect, and he was so honored to do it as well. And then we felt Marco Swoley was just, you know, we had to have Marco involved. That's James's go-to guy next to John Petrucci. And we felt, let's keep these guys, you know, let's not bring somebody in for this song. Let's keep it a real band. And I think that's contributed to the cohesive sound as well. It feels like a band playing it, and we're all extremely proud of it.
So would I be right in saying that the dynamic's a little different now that you're a co-writer with James, as opposed to James guesting on, you know, Eden's Curse?
Yeah, big time. I mean, at that point in time, he's just doing a session for us. You know, it's a song that I'd written. I actually wrote that, but the keyboard player at the time would have been Alessandro Dovecchio, who's in Hardline and lots of Frontiers type projects. So he was my co-writer on that. But it was an idea that I had for some time, and Alessandro wrote the vocal part for James and some orchestration. So he's just really contributing to a performance of a song. But he was great. You know, he would call from the studio literally and say, look, I'm just about to lay down this line. I'm thinking of this word fits better coming out of the syllable. And he was the base foundation for the backing vocal. So it showed me that this wasn't just a guy that was here to collect his money and run in over the horizon. This was a man that cared deeply about what he was just about to sing, to the point he's contacting me. You know, that's not behaviour of a normal rock star. That's behaviour of just a good bloke, you know, just a right good bloke. And that shines through in James's personality when you get to meet him. He's an honest, really likeable, you know, guy, you know, just a great upstanding person. And to work with him, that carried right through. You know, never at any point was I'm the rock star, you do what I'm saying. In fact, he would go overboard to make sure that I was happy with what he was suggesting and making me comfortable, because we'd never worked with each other to the degree that we've done on this album, never. So that was new. But the good thing was that James and I have been buddies for 10 years. So that whole, oh God, I'm writing with James LaBrie from Dream Theater just wasn't really there. It was just my friend. And I think that helped produce, you know, a relaxed feeling in my part as well. I wanted to lift my game naturally because, you know, this is a big deal for me. And it gave the best performances and he would come back and say, look, this is great. Why don't we try this? Why don't we do that? And I was able to throw the same back to James, and it really was a cohesive unit pulling it together. And Chance came in after maybe three or four songs, and he was a very strong voice within that. In fact, what I liked about Chance being in his early 20s, he was able to grab James and I, who are, let's say politely, a little bit more mature, two dinosaurs, and drag us into the modern age of, you know, let's not do a typical ballad drums, let's go for percussion. And that was amazing. You know, he had some brilliant ideas and really became the third element of, or cog in the wheel, to the point we said, look, he should have a co-production because he's been crucial in, you know, trimming some of the fat off of the arrangements. He's been great at recommending certain angles to take. So that unit, I could see, you know, we're already talking about a second album, I beg your pardon, I almost written the second one there, a third album. We've already started, putting down ideas. We haven't swapped them with each other yet, but we are working and writing. And that will definitely happen. And Chance, myself, and James will probably write that as a threesome. Yeah.
Mm. Paul, my understanding is that your main instrument is the bass guitar, and that is your instrument of choice. How did you first start playing? You know, what is your backstory, I guess, with regards to picking up the bass guitar?
So I started as a drummer, believe it or not. I started as a drummer at 15 years old, wow, at high school. I'd never taken music at school at all, but I loved growing up and listening to music. And I listened to, at the time, maybe we're between the age of 12 and 15, I was listening to the new wave of British, you know, kind of pop stuff, you know, your Spandau Ballets and things, absolute crap. But when all of a sudden I heard Living on a Prayer on the radio one day and I went, what on earth is that? Then at the same time, you had Europe's Final Countdown out. So my ears were just like, holy shit, this is the sound that I'm looking for. And my grandmother was a big collector of records, and she had stacks and stacks of LPs, and a lot of them were like chart compilations. And I would literally just go through, pick on this compilation album, put the needle at the front, and try and find that rock sound. And one of the first songs that I found, I'm thinking, crap, 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 and on comes Fool for Your Loving by Whitesnake, and I'm like, that's it. That is, I don't know what this is called, but my ears were shaping. And we had a cool local library. I'm from a very kind of small village near Glasgow. And we had a cool library with a great record collection. So once I started to hear what these bands were and what their names were, because this back in those days, you know, there's no internet. This is all through radio. So you'd be lucky to jump in halfway through a song, and you'd be lucky if the song stopped and the DJ told you who it was. I then got the Slippery When Wets, and I got like the Final Countdown albums. And then suddenly I discover that Scotland has its own rock show, and it's on a Friday night at midnight until 2 a.m. So as a 15-year-old kid, I would go to bed with my Walkman radio. And I often remember my dad taking my earphones off at maybe 1 a.m. I never had the stamina to go through. But that was the early education for me. And musically, how I fell into, you know, performing was, I remember taking a module within music, not even a main curricular exam. It was just a module to learn. And I was walking past the music room one day, and I could hear electric guitars. And I thought, where is this coming from? And it was actually the back of the sports hall. And I peered in, and there was two guys from my class, both with Stratocasters. And I was just mesmerized. I was saying, dudes, what's going on? What's this? And they said, yeah, we're going to start a rock band. And suddenly I now have two buddies that were, you know, kinsmen, where they were listening to different bands like Kiss and the Scorpions. Never heard of these bands. One of them liked Maiden. I thought Maiden were this death metal band at the time, as you do if you're not
the front
not,
cover.
Not used to. Yeah. Exactly. So I'd never heard a Maiden song, except for at the time we had a Lucozade advert with the Phantom of the Opera was the actual theme tune. Of course, there was no vocal, so you recognised the riff and the motive. And the guy said, yeah, do you know a drummer? And I went, yeah, I play drums. Total lie. I'd never been behind a drum kit in my life. Didn't even own a pair of sticks. And I say, yeah, I play drums. And they say, well, the teacher's allowing us to do some band practices so we can get the drums in the next class, which was 2 days away. So I'm running home to my mum. I need a set of drumsticks. But I knew, Nick, that I used to play along to records on pillows and things, just with pots and pans and spoons and knives and forks. So I knew I had the basis of rhythm, but then to sit behind a kit, and I sat behind it and I did okay. I wasn't great. But as that journey evolved, we started writing our own songs from a very early age. We played lots of covers. We got to perform in front of the school. We got one of the guys switched to bass. Then he left. His dad owned quite a large electrical company, so we were left without a bass player. I'd really got to the point where I thought, actually, I'm not that great. And we knew a kid in the year below who was really good, and he was into Metallica. He had long hair, so we got him in drums, and I switched to the bass. So that was my journey, kind of 15, 16 years old, trying to save up the money to buy my first second-hand bass. And from there, I got into some local Glasgow bands. I played in a Van Halen tribute for 4 years. But I was always writing songs. That was my thing. I always wrote my own songs and started writing songs for other people as well. And then formed Eden's Cursed maybe about 2005, 2006. I started the basis of that, putting it together. And it just kind of took off from there.
Now, I've got a silly question for you, man. and for a better word, does Paul Logue have a day job?
Yeah. I do, yeah. I'm a director for a software company. So I worked for IBM for 20 years. So I've always had a day job. I've got a family, I've got a wife, I've got a house, a mortgage, I've got one ass in my trousers like everyone else. And, I think certainly in my experience, I really don't know a lot of people who make a living from music, you know, maybe the exception of James. Some of my closest friends from Germany are all killer musicians, but they might play in really good bands that are actually doing quite well, but they all teach, they all do classes, they all do session work. Maybe someone like Dennis Ward would be the most successful out of the lot. He does the production side of things. But yeah, it's always allowed me to be a musician because you're able to put food on the table and a roof over the family's head. So I've been able to balance it quite well. And I think the key for me is having a band that was international. You weren't touring a lot, except for maybe every album you would do a kind of 2 week tour. We toured mainly in our own country in the UK, and we would have festival appearances abroad. So it was never me having to go to my work and ask for 4 weeks off. You know, that just didn't happen. We did a 2 week tour of Germany, and that would be the longest. So yeah, unfortunately, I love my job. I've done it for a long time. So, and doing quite well. One of the reasons Eden's Curse broke up a few years ago is I moved from IBM to a new company from LA. So I needed to just take a break from the music and really concentrate and get my feet under the table to my main gig. So yeah, that's been pretty cool. But I ended up, a funny story is I actually ended up in a work band. So one of my managers heard that I played in a band. He was a singer. He was a singer in a rock band. One guy's a jazz musician. Another dude's a jazz drummer. And we ended up playing, a gig in LA, believe it or not, which here's a guy from Scotland playing in LA with my work band. So it turned out to be quite cool.
I do apologize, man. And look, that wasn't a cryptic question. I guess the reason behind that and the reason behind that question was, you've got two demanding things. You've got your day job and obviously the band. Are you able to separate those, or do you find that they constantly, collide, for better or worse?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to kind of keep them separate. I think my journey and evolution as a musician and someone who's got a career has changed dramatically over the last few, maybe last 10, 15 years, because I was very focused on trying to make a career as a musician. And I think it depends on what your level of success should be deemed at. I never ever kind of thought that we would be living in Hollywood or anything like that. I was a realist. I knew what we could do. If this band could play in front of good attendances, if it could release records and sell records, we're very lucky. We've had a deal all of our our time with a great label like AFM Records, and they gave us lots of support. We were out with some killer artists, but I did have to make sure that during the day, I mean, I work from home, so the temptation to sit here and play music and record and write when you're working from home is huge, and you have to get past that. You have to separate it and make sure at the end of the night you're finishing your work at 5 p.m. You get the family settled. I've got a dog, so I take my dog out a walk. And sometimes, like tonight, I'm sitting down at 8 p.m. maybe doing interviews, maybe writing a song, maybe working on production. And that's just the rhythm that I got into as well. I think if this band was, if all five guys were in my local area, like my first Glasgow band that I was in, that would be just too much. I think it would be, you know, I think that would be a different story. But now where I am in my company, I would say that that goal of shooting for the moon with Eden's Curse has kind of changed dramatically. You know, we split up because of the way that the scene was. Attendances were up and down, album sales were down, and we just didn't want to do it anymore for, you know, not a tangible reward, you know, people coming and selling out shows. It just wasn't happening for us. So I had to focus on, you know, making a new career, especially at a brand new company. I just had to say Eden's Curse has to take a break and I need to concentrate on this now. And now I look at it, and with James, as a hobby that I'm very serious about and very passionate about, and I give it my all, but my day gig's my main breadwinner as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So Paul, the album's out, you're getting great reviews, great feedback. Let me ask you, will we ever see Beautiful Shade of Grey live? Has it been spoken about, talked about? Is it on the cards for the band?
Yes, it is. We're in discussions with the promoters right now, so we've got some offers for it. Again, as you can imagine, it's all about fitting in a time cycle that works for everybody, especially the boss. He's the busiest out of all of us. I'm super busy with my job as well, so, and I know all of the other guys, they've got their own bands and they all do bits of work too. We're looking at spring next year to get that out on, because I think DT are still in cycle mode right up to the end of the year. So we're just waiting on the final dates coming in from when James can do it, and then we're going back out to the promoters. So we'll start it off maybe in Europe just to see how it goes. And then, you know, if it's well received, what we would like to do, Nick, is we want to do this in a very intimate setting. The promoter that we've been offered to do some shows in kind of converted churches and monasteries, really cool venues, kind of 500 to 1,000 cap, and James is really excited about that, you know, doing it in a kind of intimate setting. We've had lots of people say, you must play this album in its entirety, and we are thinking, God, what do we do? What do we do here? Because I think all of the songs sound like they would really translate very well live. We'll do some of his other solo stuff in a kind of similar you know, approach. We'll do some, you know, DT stuff. We've been compiling lists of what DT songs would work, you know, Solitary Shell, Silent Man, etc. But it'll all be down to James what he wants to do. But absolutely, we'd love to do it. As we said, we've got some kind of concrete offers and interest. And then, you know, let's see where that leads us. Can we get out to, you know, America? Can we get to, you know, Down Under? Can we get to Japan and things like that? I don't know. It's quite exciting when we think about it all. But yeah, we definitely want to take that there for sure.
Now, Paul, before I let you go, I know you're extremely busy. It would be remiss of me not to ask, and for those that can't see this, you're wearing a Celtics cap. And I guess something that we have in common is Ange Postecoglou, who obviously was a player and coach here in Melbourne, in Australia, who's now moved to Scotland and, you know, is obviously the Celtics coach. How was he received initially?
Yeah, Ange, my God. So, yeah, I think it was well documented that Glasgow Celtic, my team, were after a particular English manager at the time, and he was just about to be literally announced, and all of a sudden he pulls out of the running, and a buddy of mine calls me and says, this dude called Ange Postecoglou is the favourite to get the Celtic job, and I said, who? And literally, that was the opinion over here. I mean, I get it totally, Nick, that it's complete football snobbery, but we hadn't a clue who this guy was. I'm I'm a bit more of an open-minded person. So the first thing I did was Google this guy and try and, you know, I'm a huge Celtic fan, so I'm soaking every bit of content I could get about this guy. I'm reading reports on him. I watched about three or four YouTube interviews, like hour-long specials about him. And I thought, actually, I like what this guy's got to say. But, you know, where you are at that point in time, our club was in a complete, they were on its knees. It was a complete disaster. It was meant to be our 10th title in a row, record-breaking season, completely imploded on itself. Our arch rivals won the title for the first time in years. And it was a miserable season. And there's no way, without a word of a lie, that we could have envisaged that this guy was going to come in and do. I mean, the first six matches, they lost three games. You lose one in Glasgow and you're one game away from the sack. That's how bad the fan power is. And Ange basically said, look, you guys like to call things early. Just calm down. I'm keeping the players away from the noise. We're going to trust the process. We're going to attack. And we'll see how we go at the end of the season. And what a season it's been. I mean, he has just given me, in my 46 years on this earth, some of the best football I've ever seen played at Celtic Park.